I'm late. I had to stop by the Wax Museum again and give the finger to FDR.
We know Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria?
It's a proud day for America. And by God, we've kicked Vietnam Syndrome once and for all. Thank you very, very much.
I say it again, you've been had. You've been took. You've been hoodwinked.
These witnesses are trying to simply deny things that just about everybody else accepts as fact.
He came, he saw, he died.
But we ain't killing they army, but we killing them. We be on CNN like, say our name, bitch, say it three times.
The meeting of the largest armies in the history of the world. Then there's going to be an invasion.
All right, you guys, again, introducing our friend Ray McGovern. This is not the same interview you just heard. It's an entirely different one. Hey, Ray, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Scott.
Very happy to have you here. You were an analyst at the CIA for 27 years, starting and ending when?
Starting in early 63 and ending with George H.W. Bush in office in January of 1990.
All right, then. So, and we'll get to that aspect of this story here in a bit, because I think there is one, if I remember right. But let's just start with the basics here. It's June the 8th, 2018. So that makes it the anniversary, again, of the Israeli attack on the USS Liberty. What's the USS Liberty, Ray?
Well, it was a Navy ship, but it was outfitted to collect electronic and other technical information from places where we needed intelligence. It operated in international waters. It had just been refurbished, and it was the most expensive intelligence collection mechanism in history. And it was sailing in international waters off the Sinai during the Six-Day War in June 1967, so 51 years ago.
Mm. And then, yeah, but so the Israelis are our most bestest friends in the whole wide world, it said on TV. And so I think that, if this really happened at all, which I'm very suspicious of, I'm pretending to be for the sake of this question, then it must have been a big accident.
Right. Let me approach this, Scott, in a personal way. I move in circles where I had long since known about this disaster and how the United States government, the United States Congress, and to its discredit, the United States Navy had all covered up the fact that Israel undeniably, with tangible evidence that we have, on purpose tried to sink the USS Liberty and leave no survivors. I will say that again, sink the USS Liberty. It had a crew of about 280, as I recall, and leave no survivors. Long story short, they did kill 34. They did wound over 170. And they're about to complete the job when one enterprising young sailor from Texas put together with baling wire a connection to a radar that the Israelis had not knocked out. They knocked out all the others. They hadn't knocked out this one because it had not been active for weeks. Well, Terry Harbajier connected those wires, sent out an SOS, and immediately the Israelis got out of Dodge, so to speak. They broke off the patrol boat, the PT boat attacks, one of which had shot a torpedo midships, and they broke off the strafing of the lifeboats, and the aircraft went home, and the PT boats went home. The commander of that part of the naval fleet in the Mediterranean immediately dispatched fighter bombers from the USS Saratoga and the USS America to relieve one of his ships that was under attack. They were called back. They were called back by none other than First Secretary of Defense McNamara. But then when Admiral Geitz had the guts to say, "Sir, Mr. McNamara, one of my ships is under attack. I'm afraid I'm not going to recall the fighter bombers on their way to do battle with whoever is attacking them. I need to speak to your supervisor. Whoa. Guess what? OBJ gets on the line. And he says, now you all call those planes back. We don't want to put a black mark on our ally Israel. Do it now and do it quickly. And so he did.
Unbelievable.
So this is, you know, this is all available in evidence. It's just not available in most U.S. newspapers. What I was thinking of is,
wait, let's just dwell on that point for just 1 second. An admiral, and you already did, but I like it. Sorry. An admiral says to the Secretary of Defense, yeah, I'm not buying that. I want to talk to your boss. And then Lyndon Baines Johnson gets on the line and tells this admiral to refute, to not defend, to call back his planes and not defend an American ship that is being attacked by a foreign government, a foreign military.
Yeah, the gutsy thing that Admiral Gates did, of course, was insist on speaking a rank above McNamara, the defense secretary, who really is dubiously in the chain of command anyway. So he wanted to talk to the commander-in-chief, but when the commander-in-chief told him what to do, well, you know, these people don't become admirals by refusing to obey orders. He did what he was told to do. And the good news was that the SOS saved the day. In other words, the Israelis intercepted it right away. They said, oh, my goodness, we better get out of here. And they did. And so there were survivors. And so there was a ship that was able to just barely make it back to Malta to be so the bodies could be taken off, and the men were taken to Greece, and each one of the survivors was visited by a senior Navy officer commander, and they were told, look, you are not allowed to say anything about what happened today. You're not allowed to talk about this with your fellow crew people, your crew members. They're all men at those days. And you are not allowed to discuss this even with your wife. And if you do, we're going to court-martial you. That was the first thing that was administered to these guys as they received first aid in Greece. So now, you want to know what PTSD looks like, Scott? You want to see what it really looks like? Well, you talk to one of those crew members who for years, for 20, 30 years, were unable to share this hard experience. Everything, not only the shoot up, but the cover up, my God, with even their wives under pain of court martial. So what I thought I'd do is just get into this in a personal way, because they started to say, I knew the story, but I didn't know any of the people. And, you know, if you're not there, you don't have an immediate touch with what happened. And if you don't know any people, well, you're double removed, in my view. So what happened? Well, gosh, it must be about 15 years ago that Professor John Mearsheimer from the University of Chicago and Stephen Walt from Harvard wrote this incredible book. It was called The Israel Lobby, okay? Now, they did it, it was first an article. It was commissioned by the Atlantic magazine. And when they saw the draft, they said, oh my, you know, thanks very much, but no thanks. We'll give you a severance or whatever it is they call it, but a kill stipend. But no, we can't publish it. They couldn't get it published anywhere. They had to go to the London Review of Books to get it published. Okay, now it was very explosive. It listed all the ways in which the Israel lobby exercised its power in this country, the United States. So here it is, published by the London Review of Books, and McGovern gets a hold of it. And he's going down to give a talk in a place called Springfield, Missouri, okay? It's an obscure, well, it's a sizable town, but this church wanted me to come down there. It was 300 people in this audience. And so on the way down, I read this article. I said, my God, holy Moses. I arrived there. I was talking about Iraq at the time. That was the live issue. And toward the end, we had a Q&A, and one of the people said, "Now, Mr. McGovern, what do you think about the USS Liberty?" Or no, that's not what they thought. They said, "What do you think of Mearsheimer and Waltz, the most recent article in London Review of Books?" And I said, thank you, Jesus. You know, I just read it, you know. So I said, "Well, you know, I just read it on a plane, and I think it's excellent. But the one thing I don't understand is if they're adducing evidence as to how Israel has inordinate influence on the United States, they missed the most convincing episode, and that is the shooting up of the USS Liberty on June 8th, 1967. I can't understand why they would miss that. I mean, that one showed that the Israelis can literally get away with murder. Now, I looked out at that audience, Scott, 300 people there, and everybody had this look of, why? USS, So I said, "Well, how many of you know about the attack on the USS Liberty?" Three people raised their hands, okay? So one in the way in the back, one in the middle. So I called one in the front. I said, "Sir, could you get up and tell us how you know about the USS Liberty?" Well, guy gets up, ramrod straight. He says, "Sergeant Bryce Lockwood, U.S. Marine Corps, member of USS Liberty crew, sir." So McGovern says, "Well, would you be able to come up and tell us what happened? I mean, that would be better than me recount." "Sir, I have not been able to do that. But it's been 35 years now. I would like to try tonight. Yes, sir." He marches up, right? And he spends 10 minutes behind the microphone telling about how his entire contingent of Marine radio intercept operators was demolished by the Israeli torpedo that hit him midships, that the only reason he was able to escape was that he was behind the bulwark. He had the sensitive encryption machinery that he was about to drop with a very large boulder over the side so that no one could get it. And just to recount how he had to go back down into that compartment, he was able to rescue one of the guys that was still alive. Another guy he had by the hand, okay, and he was trying. Somebody closed the hatch, for God's sake. He bangs on the hatch. They open the hatch, and he's pulling this other guy, and he slips out of his reach, and goes through the great hole into the Mediterranean. Well, Bryce Lockwood, he calls himself the old Sarge. He's still fit as a fiddle. He told that story, and everyone was duly moved, and that freed him up and freed a lot of his colleagues to tell that terrible story as to what happened, how the Israeli aircraft reconnoitered the USS Liberty during the morning of June 8th, 1967. You know, they're very friendly. Of course, there was, they had Israeli markings, and the pilot would be waving, and some of the sailors that were off duty would be sunbathing. Oh, very, very genial. And then all of a sudden, unmarked aircraft came back, Mirages, French Mirages, and shot up all the antennae first on the Liberty, and then started spreading napalm and all kinds of other stuff to kill the crew and sink the ship. Now, I have to tell you this vignette, too, because it's a very personal experience, and it has to do with a lot of things. One is this, that the sailor, his name was Terry Harbajie. He was from Texas. I think he was 20 at the time, 20 years old. He says to Captain McGonagall, he said, "Captain, I think that I can get that radar working, you know, the one that the Israelis don't know works, but I need to connect it with this plug and a baling wire." And McGonagall looks at him and he says, "Harbajie, what are you going to do, swim across that napalm? You're good at swimming across napalm?" Harbajie says, "I'd like to try, sir." Permission granted. He connects it, and gets the signal out. Only way that the ship wasn't sunk with the entire crew of, what, 280 or whatever it was, killed. Now, why do I mention that? Well, because gradually, and especially when Admiral Thomas Moorer, who had been chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, when he took an active interest in this case, some of it started to leak out. Some of the crewmen were actually courageous enough to write books about it. And all of a sudden, I learned that Thierry Halberdier is going to be given the Silver Star. Now, that's just below the Medal of Honor, right? I said, who's going to give him that? This congressman out there in the Central Valley of California. When? Next Wednesday. I get on a plane and I get out there and I get there the morning of the presentation, a modest conference, a modest press conference with local media there, and about seven or eight of the survivors, a couple of them I already knew. I had not met Thierry Halberdier. It turned out he was working for the local congressman there, a fellow named Devin Nunes, who had the guts to insist that the Army approve a Silver Star for his staffer, Thierry Halberdier. The ceremony was not with great flourish. It was very earnest, and everyone was just delighted that Thierry got recognition for saving the ship and the crew. We went out to lunch after that, and I tell you, when I said before, if you want to know what PTSD looks like, think about sailors who went through this experience and then were told they couldn't confide even to their wives as to what really happened. Think about all the lies that were told that it was a great big mistake by the Israelis. We know it wasn't a mistake. We have intercepted communications from pilot to ground control. Okay, here it is. That's an American ship. That's an American flag. Follow your orders. But it's an American. Do what you're told. Follow your orders. Boom. Okay? So it's not like we're making this stuff up. It's out there in, actually, it was used as case studies in intelligence school at Fort Halliburton when the intelligence school was there. So if I feel a little emotional about this, well, I think that anybody who has had even though secondhand experience with actual people involved in this, if you're not emotional, you're not human.
Hey, y'all, Scott here. Here's how to support the show. Patreon.com/Scott Horton Show if you want to donate per interview. And also ScottHorton.org/donate. Anyone who donates $20 gets a copy of the audiobook of Fool's Errand. Anyone who donates $50, that'll get you a signed copy of the paperback in the mail there. And anyone who donates $100 gets either a QR code commodity disc or a lifetime subscription, not only for $100, not two, a lifetime subscription to Listen and Think audiobooks, libertarian audiobooks, listenandthink.com there. So check out all that stuff. And of course, we take all your different digital currencies, especially Zencash and all the different kinds of Bitcoins and whatevers are all there at scotthorton.org/donate. And get the book, Fool's Errand. And give it a good review on Amazon if you read it and you liked it, and review the show on iTunes and Stitcher and that kind of thing if you want. All right, thanks. All right, well, so tell me about what was going on at CIA headquarters in 1967 when the Israelis attacked an NSA ship and LBJ and McNamara helped them get away with it. I mean, and I know you guys are all supposed to be compartmentalized and you're an analyst, not a spy, and I don't know what, but certainly everybody's gossiping, at least in the cafeteria at lunchtime, that like, man, did you hear what the Israelis did or not or what? Tell me.
Yeah, well, I was working on Soviet foreign policy at the time, but of course the Russians were involved in the Middle East as well, so I had a window into this. There was a really interesting schizophrenia among the analysts of Israel, Arab states at CIA. One thing that will boggle your mind is this, that when I arrived in 1963, 64, and started to get my sea legs, and wandering around finding out who else is involved, particularly in the Middle East, since the Soviet Union was so much involved there, I learned, or looked around, and I saw, whoa, huh. You know, in the Arab-Israeli branch, there are no people of Jewish extraction. And I said to myself, holy Moses, that's odd. I wonder if this is deliberate. So I chose my time carefully, and I asked the branch chief there. I say, you have no people of Jewish extraction here. Is that an accident? He says, no, it's not an accident, Ray. We just think that in order to get the really objective analysis here, it's just a precaution. He said, we don't have any Arabs either. You notice that? I said, yeah, I noticed that. And he said, so now what was McGovern's reaction? Big liberal McGovern. You know, he said, oh, that's terrible. That's un-American. Oh, that's you know, how can you do that? You know, well, guess what? Guess what? It was a very enlightened policy. And I'll just fast forward to now.
Well, wait a minute, though, you terrible anti-Semite, you, for remembering that. What about Mix on Irish policy or whatever? You know, was it like that on everything, or is it just Jews in Israel?
Well, you know, it's really funny you should mention that, because later I had a higher office. I was the acting national intelligence officer for Western Europe, okay? Now, that was in the 70s, mid-70s, when all hell broke loose in Northern Ireland. Now, I know a lot about Ireland. I have cousins there. I've been there many, many times. And I was deathly afraid that the head of analysis would come down and say, McGovern, you know a lot about Ireland. We want you to be the analyst on the troubles there between North and South Ireland and what's going on, the troubles that are going on, and as they call them, in Northern Ireland. Now, I would have to say, Scott, I would have to say, no way, no way will I take that job. My ethos in intelligence and the ethos of those around me in those days was, we need to be really, really careful not to let any personal bias interfere with our analysis. And it is constitutionally impossible for me, for my constitution, for me to be objective about what's going on in Northern Ireland. Sorry, Mr. Casey, I can't do that. Find somebody else.
But that's, they didn't even ask you, or they did?
No, they didn't.
They didn't even ask you, so you didn't have to turn it down.
That's correct. But, you know, I was worried, and I kept thinking about this, because not many people knew much about what was going on in Ireland. And, you know, most of the data was coming from MI6 and MI5, and, you know, British friends were giving a slightly slanted view of what's going on there. But I held my peace. I chipped in with the analysts themselves as to what I knew, but no one asked me to do that. But, you know, that's...
To be clear about this, this is not some kind of, you know, old school latent, you know, bigotry in the system that you're reminiscing about here. This is just simply professionalism and trying to prevent conflicts of interest when it comes to intelligence analysis, right? I'm sorry, we're kind of off on a tangent here, but it's important.
Yeah, well, I'm glad we're on that tangent, because it is a very important consideration. You know, it's really hard. It's very difficult, because let's say you want somebody who knows a whole lot about Egypt or Syria. Well, most of the people will be of Arab extraction, you know, and it's really hard to find people equally competent, but you can. And what I'm saying here is that the people who had their heads screwed on correctly in the early 60s, at least, made a conscious effort to make sure that they got those people with no dual allegiance, as we say, no people who qualify for Israeli or Arab citizenship. So, you know, that was really, really important. And I need to say that right now, and what I know of the last two decades, the Arab-Israeli branch is run by and populated mostly by people who are of Jewish extraction. There are very few people who give a balanced view with respect to what the Arabs' grievances are, what the Palestinian situation is all about. That's very different from the old days, and it's part of the total corruption of the analysis division of CIA. I'll say one more thing, Scott, because it's important. Even with this unbiased crew of analysts back in the 60s. Well, we'll talk about 67 when the attack took place on the Liberty. There was this real respect and admiration for the Israeli military capability. You know, the Arabs were looked on as feckless, militarily speaking. Of course, they weren't in receipt of any of our weaponry. That's one of the reasons, of course. But there was this prejudice, really. I think that's not too strong a word. When the Israelis struck out at something with their U.S. equipment, they usually succeeded. So there was this almost overt admiration for Israel's military capability. Now, with respect to the incident itself, we were really worried that the Russians would get overtly involved on behalf of the Arabs. After all, the Russians and we and everyone else who followed that situation knew that the Israeli justification for this attack was what in the Bronx we call a crock, okay? Now, how do I know that? Well, you have to take McGovern's word for it. It was none other than former Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin. Now, this was 35 years ago, but this is what he said in the speech, and this is what was reported in the New York Times. Surprise, surprise. I quote, this is Menachem Begin, former Prime Minister of Israel. In June 1967, we had a choice. The Egyptian army concentrations and the Sinai approaches do not prove that Nasser was really about to attack us. We must be honest with ourselves. We decided to attack him. New York Times, August 1982. So I guess, you know, you feel a little headstrong every now and then. You're a former prime minister, you tell the truth. And I'll just repeat. Nasser was not really about to attack us. We must be honest with ourselves. We decided to attack him. Now, we know that as a result of that attack and that war, Israel occupied territories for the last 51 years in Palestinian lands, in Gaza, which is the biggest open-air prison in the world's history, in the West Bank. And I was just there last year at this time. That was what the Germans or the Nazis called Lebensraum, okay, room to live, widen the borders. And what the Israelis have been doing ever since is colonizing those areas, putting down the Arab and Palestinian populations. And so here we have the prime minister admitting that it was a war of aggression. But the Israeli influence with the United States, first and foremost, but also in Western Europe, particularly Germany, where the Germans all still have a very guilty conscience, which they should, there can't be any balanced view of this thing so that the Palestinians will be given a fair shot at a decent life.
By the way, I just want to mention here one more footnote for that. 6 days in Israel, 45 years ago. And this is by Miko Peled, who's the son of a powerful former Israeli general. And he tells his own side of that and says that it was the military cabinet, whatever, the very top group of generals, and then the civilian cabinet. And the prime minister at the time was relatively weak. And the Egyptians had made the mistake of moving their, much of their armor within range, where the Israelis could hit them without having to get any nearer, basically, and that this wasn't a threat. And the only question was not whether, what are the Egyptians going to do and are we going to defend ourselves or anything like that? It was simply, are we going to take advantage of this opportunity or are you going to let it pass by, you weakling prime minister? And the prime minister gave in to the generals and they launched the war. And that's 6 days in Israel, 45 years ago, from the son of the general who did it.
Yeah, well, that's Miko Peled. And, what he says, you can take to the bank. He's a close personal friend of mine. Matter of fact, we'll be together this afternoon at DuPont Circle in Washington, speaking at a major rally on behalf of those poor people in Gaza, 120 of whom have killed and thousands injured.
You know, let's talk about Gaza because there's so much to talk about. But hang on a second because we still got some USS Liberty stuff here. Now, okay. So we have to assume, and I probably didn't set this up very good at the beginning anyway, Ray, but I don't know. But assuming, you know, for people who aren't familiar with this story at all, it sounds kind of crazy. I mean, obviously, you know what you're talking about. It must have happened. But help people understand how this happened, why this happened. It seems like an awful risk for Israel to attack an American Navy ship for any reason or pretext. Was this what was it, Ray?
Well, we have to make a really clear distinction between what happened, and we know chapter and verse on that. I already mentioned some of the intercepted messages, pilot to control tower, and why it happened. We don't know exactly why it happened. We have some theories, and, you know, we could probably find out if we just went and asked the Israelis. Can you imagine, you know?
Yeah.
You should ask
Mikko Pellet. Does he know?
No, he didn't. Well, you know, the theories are, and this is the best one in my view, they knew that the USS Liberty was collecting all the intelligence that was available in the air or in the ether. Right outside, right in international waters, mind you, 13 miles off the Sinai. Now, there are two possible explanations that have equal merit, in my view. One is that the Israelis were about to go up and take the Golan Heights from Syria the next day. In those days, there was no way for the Israelis to prepare that kind of offensive. Didn't take an awful lot. They had already destroyed the Syrian Air Force. But there was no way for them to do that in secret. Now, the last thing the Israelis wanted was to give the United States of America any chance to say, no, stop now. You've done it. You know, the Russians might intervene now. You don't need the Golan Heights. Look, you got the Sinai, you got Gaza, you got West Bank. My God, don't do this. That's what they didn't want. Now, the Israelis are very adept at preferring to ask for forgiveness rather than permission. And they knew that the USS Liberty would intercept all the information they needed to wire back to Washington and say, look, the Israelis are going up in the Golan. The Israelis just didn't want to give our ambassador or our military attaché or our defense minister, McNamara at the time, any chance to say, look, you do this and you're going to pay a price. Don't do this. They didn't want that, and so they went ahead, and it was they seized the Golan Heights. That's the first and the best, I think, speculation. The second one has to do with prisoners. Now, the Israeli army came down through the Sinai on three axes, right? And they captured lots of Egyptians that couldn't defend themselves, and they ended up with a couple of hundred prisoners of war. And they gathered in this place right off in the Sinai, right off the Mediterranean there. And, you know, prisoners of war are a real pain. That's why drones are so great. You can't just kill them. You don't have to feed them. You don't have to water them. You don't have to guard them. And, you know, the Israeli army was not all that big. They didn't want to be, you know, deflected by having to guard all these prisoners or feed them and water them. And so there were two Israeli journalists there that watched the Israelis shoot up these prisoners and put them in a ditch. Now, they have written books about this. No one has disputed their authenticity. But the second theory would be that since this U.S. intelligence collection ship, the USS Liberty, was only 13 nautical miles offshore, and they could see what was going on, and of course, capture the SIGINT, the signals intelligence, that the last thing the Israelis wanted was for the American public or anyone to know, even the U.S. Navy, what they were doing with these Egyptian prisoners. Now, they did do those things with the Egyptian prisoners, whether or not that was enough to explain why this all happened, I'm not sure. The other factor, of course, is Russia. They didn't want Russia to be involved, and if they could get the U.S. involved and could pretend that it was an Egyptian ship that sunk the Liberty, there might be extra insurance there. So, what I want to emphasize is the difference between what we know what happened and what we don't know, and the reason we don't know it is because nobody has had the guts to go and ask.
Right.
So tell us, you know.
Well, go back to what was going on at CIA at the time. And I mean, you said you had a window into this because of, you know, the fear that the Soviet Union might become involved. But so what all did you know then?
Well, I didn't know about the McNamara and Johnson conversation with Admiral Geis. That was, of course, very closely held, and I'm not even sure anybody at CIA headquarters was apprised of that. All we knew was that the Israelis had done this wonderful job, but that it was the wrong ship. And there was a lot of consternation. But when we got the intercepts, we knew that they had done it deliberately. Mm-hmm. And,
you guys got the intercepts right away?
Yeah. It comes through NSA and they're shared with us. And, you know, it was like the Gulf of Tonkin. We also know that that second attack was a crock, that it never happened. But we were deprived of the opportunity to put that in our publications and share it with Congress and other people. Even Fulbright was full speed ahead on the Tonkin Gulf resolution. So there are limits to what intelligence can do. I didn't know chapter and verse. And I think it's a 50-50 chance that no one, except mm-hmm. maybe the director himself, was involved in knowing. He would have had no role to play, but in knowing that the commander-in-chief, Lyndon Johnson, had told Admiral Geis to withdraw those planes and let the Israelis off scot-free and then participate in a cover-up which lasted, you know, 40, 45 years. You know, it's Admiral Maurer. Before he died, and he was, you know, he was a straight arrow Navy admiral. He was just shocked at all this. And, you know, one of the things he said, I have this in it, I think I could find it. Yeah, he says, you know, Maurer and U.S. Ambassador Ed Peck, a friend of mine who served many years in the Middle East, they both condemned Washington's attitude toward Israel as, quote, obsequious, unctuous subservience at the cost of the lives and morale of our service members and their families, end quote. Well, that's what it was. And if you look at the only sensible State Department advisor that LBJ had in those days, George Ball, he wrote a book about this, Passionate Attachment. It's an incredible book. Guess what? Look for somebody to review it. Huh? This is 50 years ago. Has it been reviewed? Well, maybe in consortiumnews.com.
Yeah.
So this all is kept out of circulation. Americans don't know the first thing about the Liberty. And maybe it would be, you know, Maurer did his own investigation, okay? And he uncovered the fact that the Navy lawyer turned out to be the Navy liar. And he had a pang of conscience before he too died. And he admitted, you know, I just did what they told me to do. We were told to say that it was a terrible mistake and the Israelis apologized. So just let it be. His name was Captain Boston. And, he admitted all this. But the Blue Ribbon Independent Commission that Maurer assembled to look into this made just, you know, let me just name two of the conclusions. Quote, unmarked Israeli aircraft dropped napalm canisters on the USS Liberty Bridge, fired 30-millimeter cannon and rockets into the ship. Survivors estimate 30 or more sorties were flown over the ship by a minimum of 12 attacking Israeli aircraft. Number two, the torpedo boat attack involved not only the firing of torpedoes, but machine gunning of Liberty's firefighters and stretcher bearers. The Israeli torpedo boats later returned to machine gun at close range three of the Liberty's life rafts that had been lowered into the water by survivors to rescue the most seriously wounded, end quote. Now, this is not McGovern. This is not some anti-Semite. This is Admiral Thomas Moore, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who took it upon himself to appoint his own blue ribbon panel of Navy and other people, lawyers and so forth. And this was two of their findings. So, yeah, it was pretty bad. And I am going down. I think I'd still make it down to Arlington Cemetery, as I have every year, where there's a small gathering now. We had a rather large one last year for the 50th anniversary, but there's an unmarked, well, it's a marked grave now of some of the survivors that they couldn't figure out who was who and which head belonged to which torso. That's a very moving ceremony. Lately, a general came 2 years ago, and so some Navy brass is gradually becoming aware of this indignity, and we are getting a little bit respect, and the Arlington Cemetery folks are very accommodating normally.
Hey, let me tell you about the sponsors of this show. First of all, Mike Swanson. He is the author of the great book, The War State, about the permanence of America's World War II military empire through the Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy administrations, the rise of the new right military-industrial complex after World War II, The War State by Mike Swanson, and also get his great investment advice to protect your financial future there at WallStreetWindow.com. He has a great understanding of what the hell is going on in these financial markets. WallStreetWindow.com. Unless I know he'll tell you, you got to have at least some of your savings. You must know. Some of your savings, however much it is, you got to have metals. And so what you do is you go to Roberts and Roberts Brokerage, Inc., gold, silver, platinum, palladium. They have a very small brokerage fee in order to process for you and get you the very best deal. And if you buy with Bitcoin, there's no premium at all for your purchases of gold, silver, platinum, palladium. So check those guys out. Roberts and Roberts Brokerage, Inc. at rrbi.co. You ever play baseball? rrbi.co. And as I mentioned, Zencash is a great new digital currency. It's also an encrypted method of internet messaging and document transfer and all kinds of things for your business, for your secret conspiracies. Zencash.com. Check that out at zensystem.io. You can read all about how it works, every last detail, of course, at zensystem.io. And then there's this book about how to run your technology business like a libertarian. It's called No Dev, No Ops, No IT. And each of those is one word, three words, you know, get it? Yeah. No Dev, No Ops, No IT. It's by Hussein Badakhshani, and it's about how to run your business right in a libertarian way. LibertyStickers.com. I guess Rick didn't like the great new website, so we'll have to wait. Someday we'll get a new website. There's still a lot of good stickers on there, but we've got a lot of good art that's not up there yet. I don't know, man. LibertyStickers.com. That's the new slogan. I don't know. And Tom Wood's Liberty Classroom. If you like learning things, I'll get a commission if you sign up by way of the link on my website. And listen, if you want a new, and the reason my website is down is my own broken servers. But if you want a new good-looking website like the one I do have when it's up and running at scotthorton.org, then check out expanddesigns.com/scott. expanddesigns.com/scott, and you will save $500 on your new website. All right, now, so if the attack had succeeded and the ship had been sunk, they would have just blamed it on Egypt?
That was the Israeli intent. Whether they would have gotten away with it, well, God, you tell me, Scott. If LBJ was unwilling to let his aircraft do battle with who was attacking the Liberty, I suppose one could reason that that would be covered up as well, and it'd be blamed on the Russians, and that would be blamed on the Egyptians, and the Russians. And what the Israelis did want was the U.S. to get involved militarily. So that's another possible explanation as to why they tried to sink the whole thing and leave no survivors. The more predominant explanation, of course, is that the machinery, we used to do these things on tape, the tapes of all those conversations that happened in the Sinai and elsewhere between the control tower and Tel Aviv and so forth, that they were all perishable and could be sunk to the bottom of the Med. Nobody would know what really happened, and the Israelis would be free to spin their own yarn. So,
well, and perhaps part of their calculation in the first place was, don't worry about LBJ, we can count on him.
Well, unfortunately, Jesus. That was the case then, and even more unfortunately now, this is the case now. And we're talking about Iran now. And there is no reason in God's earth that Iran poses a strategic or even tactical hostility position toward the United States of America. The Israelis try to make it seem that they do pose a danger to them. And indeed, Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, now actually part of the Lebanese government, they do have the wherewithal to fight the Israelis once the Israelis attack southern Lebanon. That's new. That was shown in on the ground, so to speak, about 6 or 7 years ago. So the Israelis feel like they don't have total dominance over that part of the world. So the best thing for them would be to snooker someone like Donald Trump and John Bolton into starting a dust-up, which would allow them to wreak air and missile damage on their arch rival, Iran. The other thing I'll say about Iran is that probably no one has told Trump this, but this charge that Iran is the foremost sponsor of international terrorism, that was true 40 years ago, okay? 40 years ago. It's not true now. It's not true at all.
The U.S. has been fighting for Iran since 2001, so what the hell they're complaining about? Maybe they're mad because the Iranians really owe us a drink or something after giving them Baghdad and backing the Hazaras in Afghanistan this whole time for them and giving them an excuse to increase their power and influence in Syria in order to fight the CIA's Al-Qaeda terrorists there, you know. Yeah. I guess, you know, I'd resent that too. Anyway, we don't want to redo too much of the other day's interview. I wanted to point out that when we were talking the other day about Dennis Blair went and told the Israelis, we're not going to have another USS Liberty incident. This is what you referred to in our last interview, that now this is what we're talking about, USS Liberty incident, for those who didn't know. It's the biggest deal in the whole world that people have never heard of. And then, of course, as you're saying, the fact that people have never heard of it goes to show just how powerful the Israel lobby is in the United States of America. There's no History Channel special about this, and there's not going to be.
Yeah, it was actually Admiral Mike Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs
Mullen.
Of Staff.
I always screw that up.
The Israeli counterparts on this at a time when they were actually threatening to do something and get us involved. So he read the Riot Act to them, and that was just sort of his ace in the hole, saying, look, we know what you did. We know what you did on June 8th, 1967. You think you've hidden that from us? Well, not from us, not from us Navy admirals, all right? Yeah. Don't even think about trying to do something like that again.
And that's just amazing that he would invoke that to them in that context. And it does go to show how worried the Obama group was in 2012 about what Netanyahu was going to do.
Well, you know, what's really interesting is that the Israelis kept threatening to do it anyway. Now, we discussed ad nauseum how the U.S. intelligence estimate said in 2007, November, that that Iran had stopped working on a nuclear weapon 4 years earlier, right? We knew about that. And yet the Israelis kept telling our statesmen, our military, and our president, no, they're doing it. They're working on a nuclear, and we have to zap them. Well, what happens? Well, U.S. Statesman, so to speak, at the State Department and in the New York Times. And I'm thinking of David Sanger, who tells this story with great pride. Long story short, we bought the Israelis off because we thought they were going to attack Iran and we didn't want to get involved. And so he said, look, this is what we could do. Have your intelligence guys in Mossad talk with our guys at CIA and NSA. We can develop this this virus. Let's call it Stuxnet, okay? Yeah. And what we'll do is we'll not only fool around with the electronics, we will destroy. Yeah. We can destroy Iranian centrifuges. The most advanced ones that they've built, we'll destroy as many as we can. And would you please then not, if we do that together, would you please not attack Iran? That's what went down. That's how Stuxnet got involved. It was to preempt what the Israelis were going to do on the basis of their false claims that the Iranians were working on a nuclear weapon. Now, you know what happened with Stuxnet. Yeah, it did get out. It did cause immeasurable damage. And one can reason or one can argue that physically destroying centrifuges, sure, they're developing nuclear fuel. But Iran has this great big domestic nuclear energy program, and there was not an iota of evidence that they were turning that into a weapons-related program. And yet, Israel intelligence dominated, just like it dominated before the attack on Iraq. That's how serious all this is. Yeah. And the thing is, of course, most Americans know neither chapter nor verse on this, given the witness the fact that here I am in this big church of very progressive people, and out of 300, only 3 had even heard about the USS Liberty.
Yeah. All right. Now, listen, I want to mention real quick here. I have interviews. I'm having server problems, so some of the older archives are down, but you can find them all on YouTube, everybody. And there's Joe Metters. There's actually 2 different interviews of Joe Metters. And then there's another one of Ron Kukal. That's K-U-K-A-L. And both of those gentlemen, survivors of the USS Liberty attack, that you can find the archives. And in fact, when I searched YouTube, Scott Horton and USS Liberty, there are 5 or 6 results for Ray McGovern interviews in the past where we've talked about this as well. If people want to go back and take a look at those and share them around, because it is such a shocking story. But now, so I'm glad we still have a few minutes here to talk about what's going on in the Gaza Strip, Ray. And you said you're going to an action this afternoon there in D.C. So listen, I just saw This Is Gaza is a great Twitter feed to follow. And they've got pictures from the protest march today. Just a massive sea of people. And they're playing volleyball and they're having a good time. And people might say they're a bunch of Hamas terrorists. But yeah, actually, they look like a bunch of Americans. You know, if you took the context away, they're just humans like everybody else. And here they are doing an MLK style, Gandhi style, nonviolent action to just protest the fact that they're in prison simply for being born the wrong religion.
Well, yeah, it's about the most horrendous situation you can imagine. I've been over to Israel and the West Bank a couple of times, and none of those occasions was I able to get into Gaza. I was on the U.S. boat to Gaza. This was in 2011, okay? Now, that's 7 years ago. The previous year, the Mavi Marmara, a very large boat, Turkish flagged, was shot up by the Israelis together with a couple of other ships, on one of which Ann Wright, my colleague, was. Now, they killed 9 people.
Including an American citizen, too.
That's exactly
shot him
right.
Point blank range in the head as he was already down laying on the ground.
Yeah. And so here we are the next year. What we did was we said, look, we need a U.S. flagged ship. We took up donations and we got a really nice medium-sized boat put together and a terrific tarpaulin over the top with a boat-sized U.S. American flag, okay? We gathered in Athens, and we were ready to sail. And we had a terrific boatload of people, including, guess what, people from the New York Times, people from Reuters, people from Bloomberg, In other words, this was going to be a big deal, right? We had other, we had dignitaries on there. As soon as I remember the name of Alice Walker was with us, you know, I mean, this was a big deal. And we're all really enthusiastic because number one, it was an American flag ship. What would the Israelis do to that? And number two, we had a special forces guy from the former Israeli, a former guy from the Israeli army who dove under our ship every morning to make sure that the propeller had not been severed, as two other of these ships had happened to them. So what happens? Okay, so we're ready to go, and all of a sudden we hear, no, your air conditioner doesn't pass inspection. Air conditioner? We don't have any air conditioner. They're talking about a fan. Okay. Oh, so we smelled a rat. Guess what? Obama went to Netanyahu, and he said, look, Bibi, we got this ship now. It's really a boat. We got about 50 people. They want to get into Gaza just to, you know, show the flag and go through the blockade. So please.
Don't
please
sink don't, it now.
Please don't shoot it up like it did last year with the Marvy Mamer and the others. Okay. And we get this Sphinx-like smile from Netanyahu. And Obama says, now, please, look, you know, this is a U.S. flagship, so, you know, you're not going to do what you did last year. No answer from Netanyahu. So what does Obama do? He leans all over the Greeks, who needed a lot of financial aid at the time and still do. He said, look, you let those boats sail from Greek harbors. No more IMF loans, folks. You got that? God, I mean, you want to talk about subservience, unctuous obedience to a country other than your own? That's what happened. So what do? We sailed anyway. We got our captain in a whole peck of trouble, and we had to bail him out in U.S. courts. But he sailed, and we got 9 nautical miles off, out of Piraeus, out of Athens. And it was the most exhilarating 20, 25 minutes I've ever experienced. And then the Ninja Turtle uniformed PT boats, Greek Coast Guard, intercepted us, and very apologetically. I mean, look, here's Greece, a seafaring nation for like 100 million years, right? And they're saying, oh, sorry, we can't let you out of our waters. And we said, who says? Well, we can't tell you who said, you know. So we smelled that rat. There was a standoff for about an hour, and they pleaded with us. And finally, we said, well, now they're going to board us and shoot us up, or not shoot us up. At least they'll board us. We don't want that. We took the ship. We took the boat back. And that was the end of the U.S. boat to Gaza. So, you know, this is really, really flagrant bowing to a guy like Netanyahu. When if Obama couldn't have said, look, let these guys through, which he didn't, well, nobody, Trump's not going to do that either. And Gaza, of course, is the flashpoint here. The Palestinians, for listeners that haven't followed this, with silent marches proclaiming their right to return to their homes, which were taken over by the Israelis, they get shot up. Last count, I think, was 119 people killed, okay, by Israeli snipers. 13,000, okay, count that, 13,000 injured. They shoot at your leg with these bullets that explode on their way out the size of a golf ball, okay? And there was no particular reason for the Israelis to do this. No one was armed. And the New York Times, you'll see, will blame this all on Hamas, and so will our representative at the UN. So it's a very disgraceful performance by our government, all because no one heeded the warning of our first president, also a general, his name was Washington, who said, you know, the worst thing we can do in foreign affairs is have a passionate attachment to another country on the false belief that the objectives and the behavior of that country coincide with our own. And that's what we've had with Israel ever since John Kennedy was killed. And that's what we have now in spades.
All right, everybody. That's the great Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst and co-founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, regular writer at consortiumnews.com and antiwar.com. And check out his own website at raymcgovern.com as well. Thanks again, Ray. Appreciate it.
Most welcome.
All right, so you guys know the deal. FoolsErrand.us for the book, ScottHorton.org, and YouTube.com/ScottHortonShow for all the interviews. 4,500 of them now, going back to 2003 for you there. Read what I want you to read at antiwar.com and at libertarianinstitute.org, and follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show. Thanks.